Dear Mr. President, Canaan was a turbulent land, a place of endemic violence. Those whom the camp of Israel sent out to view and spy out Canaan were unnerved by the omnipresence of armed bands and by the constant wailing of the orphans. Their fear was reflected in their report. This land, they said, this land is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. Though written 3,000 years ago and of quite another place, I know of no better description of that bedeviled country we now call Vietnam. This land is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof. And I submit to you, Mr. President, that on this shrunken globe, no nation can sit idly by indifferent to the agony of another. And that when your own nation has played a major role in a national tragedy, its citizenry cannot turn aside nor be silent. In the Bible that you and I both deeply cherish, there is this phrase: there is a way which seemeth right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. You believe, I know, that our policy of military intervention in South Vietnam is right. And you are troubled, I know, that the ends thereof are the ways of escalation, search and kill, of burning, terror in the night, the ways of death. I understand and I appreciate your urgent efforts to secure a political solution to this tragic military confrontation. I appreciate and I understand your frustration that your tenders of negotiation have been met with cold silence. I believe that, Mr. President, that the greatness of a great leader is measured by his ability to accept frustration. And I would submit to you, sir, that there is nothing to be gained by acerbating the war, by escalating the conflict. Believing, as I do, that military involvement was not and is not an effective policy in Southeast Asia, I would urge now not the escalation of conflict, patience, restraint, and realism. The recognition that if there are privileged sanctuaries to the north, the Red River Delta, the cities of Haiphong and Hanoi, there are also privileged sanctuaries to the south, in the shipping lanes of the South China Sea, and in the estuaries of Saigon Harbor. And that if terror spreads to the north, it can easily be spread to the south. And I would emphasize, too, the recognition that though you have pledged unconditional negotiation, though there is no reason to doubt, as indeed I do not doubt, the sincerity of your proffer, in effect, you seem to be demanding that we win at the conference table what we have not been able to win on the battlefield: the political integrity of that nation called South Vietnam, carved out arbitrarily by the Geneva Conference of 1954 under government in Saigon. We pledge that we will remove our troops to the sea. The Viet Cong remove their troops to the north. But I submit to you, sir, as you well know, the Viet Cong not only include North Vietnamese insurgents and subversives, but South Vietnamese rebels, some of whom have fought for a dozen years and more against what they consider to be a tyrannical, undemocratic, unrepresentative, corrupt, and worse, government in their capital, in Saigon. I do not believe, as some seem to believe, that terror will bring about the conference table. I do believe that restraint and patience may. Mr. President, you have asked your critics for practical suggestions. I confess that I have none. As an historian, I know that there are many times in history which are inauspicious, where tempers are frayed, and the balance of power is such that neither side is prepared to give an inch. But there are also changes in the tides of history, shifts of the political climate, shifts in the economic and political realities of life. And I am firm in my conviction that given steadiness and patience and realism, a political solution will be found for South Vietnam, and peace will be brought to that benighted, God-forsaken land. For that land cries out for peace. Its plantations are overgrown, its fields are fallow, its irrigation ditches are trodden under. Poverty and disease are rampant. Death is a daily companion. Every day, men die, women die, children die. What will we have gained, Mr. President, if we save this small land from communism only to have dashed its vitality, to have drained away its moral fiber, only to have returned a broken, desperate people to a scorched and shattered place? There is a way which seemeth right to a man, the ends thereof are the ways of death. I believe that there will be a political solution in South Vietnam. My concern is that the United States does not trap itself again into a similar situation. I should like to raise with you, sir, in this letter the question whether the way which seemeth right to you, the way of military involvement, the way of containment, is in effect the right way. It seems to me, sir, that it is an unreasonable response to an irrational fear, an unreasonable response to an irrational fear. I label it unreasonable because I am firm in my belief that the United States lacks the human resource fight a land war on the Asian mainland. Now, I make no claim, sir, to be a military expert, but I am given to understand that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, our military experts, did in fact make that judgment in 1954, when war in Southeast Asia was first proposed by our government. It was held then that we could not win a technological victory simply by putting our shells and our planes and our ships into action. That men would have to be put into the jungles, into the river valleys, into the hill countries. And it was held then by all except Admiral Radford in the highest level of our military that we lacked the logistic support the manpower reserve to achieve victory under those means. I submit that the validity of this judgment still holds. I believe that our policy of military effort in Southeast Asia is an unreasonable response to an irrational fear. What is the irrational fear? It is the almost phobic concern by many in this nation that there is a controlled, unified, cunning international communist conspiracy worldwide, effective, aimed at the overthrow of all the free governments of the world. A conspiracy, communist domination are part of the doctrine of communist philosophy. But sir, there is doctrine, there is dogma, and there is life, reality. And as we have seen of recent years, nationalism, ethnic consciousness, the concern of individual nations within the communist bloc for their own political advance, even against other communist nations, has tended to predominate. There has been the breakup of Peking and Moscow. Our own government has found it advisable to give foreign aid to communist Yugoslavia, to communist Poland. We found it advisable to trade with communist Romania and communist Hungary and communist Yugoslavia and with the Soviet Union itself. There are subversives, communist subversives, in many nations of the world. There are CIA agents in many nations of the world. The era of the Cold War is one which has made the paramilitary adventure part of the international policy of every government. But I wonder if this fear of a communist conspiracy of subversion is truly a rational fear sufficient to be the basis of our policy. We have said that we are in South Vietnam in order to prevent the takeover of Vietnam by a communist government. And our fear seems to be that if South Vietnam becomes communist today, Thailand will be undermined tomorrow, the Philippines next week, Japan next month. Within the year, we may be fighting subversion in Hawaii, in our own West Coast. Now, I submit to you, sir, that had the worst come about, had a truly, fully communist government been established in all of South Vietnam, are we so certain that that government would have been a willing handmaiden and tool of Peking or of Moscow? Is it not now patently clear that Viet nationalism has for 1,000 years stood in the way of Chinese expansion to the south? History tells us that the Chinese have never been able to establish effective hegemony, suzerainty in this area. Recent events tell us one of the reasons that Ho Chi Minh was unwilling in 1954, was willing in 1954, to abide by the Geneva Conference and to have the International Control Commission established in his land, was not that it gave him defense to the south, but that control posts, international control posts, were established along his northern border with China to prevent the incursion Chinese agents into his land. And I wonder if the reason that he has not summoned Chinese armies to his aid now, it lies not in the fact that he fears that those who come to aid will stay to rule. I wonder, sir, if our policy of military interposition has not in effect hastened the very situation that we fear. And if encountering American massive military strength, Hanoi has not had to fall more and more within the Chinese nationalist expansionist sphere, whether we have not made Viet nationalism less possible, weakened it, and made it less less of a factor in international affairs. Last year, Mr. President, you said in a speech at the Johns Hopkins University, "Americans and Asians are dying for a world where each people may choose its own path to change." I believe that there is great truth in this statement. I believe that American policy has indeed, around the world, been interested in allowing people the freedoms to establish their own form of government. I believe there is truth, great truth, to the charge that for a long time now, North Vietnamese have been encouraging the revolution in South Vietnam, if not in effect, wholly supporting it. But I wonder, sir, if it can truly be said that North Vietnamese infiltration of South Vietnam precipitated or required the massive military retaliation by our government. More to the point, I wonder if our 12 years of support for the Diems and the Khais in Saigon is, in effect, a policy designed so that each people may choose its own path to change. How does the support of a tyrant, how does the support of a dictator, how does the support of one who oppresses and suppresses dissent, how does such a policy, and it is our, has been our policy, jive with our concern that each nation may choose its own path to change? I submit that for all of our pretense of concern for the interests of the Vietnamese people, to protect, as you have put it so often, this brave little people in their freedom, submit that the overriding concern of the United States and of all parties who have impinged on the tragedy of South Vietnam has been the geopolitical concerns of the colossal powers and the Cold War. The Vietnamese have suffered horror and worse because they have become chess pieces in the game of international politics. Let me try and make this point. 1945, the victorious Allied nations met at Potsdam to organize the post-war world. In 1945, in the power vacuum which came about with the Japanese surrender, those Vietnamese who had for 30 years and more fought French colonial rule and who had during the 40s fought Japanese military rule, united in a popular front party and created the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. There were communists in the government. There were socialists in the government. There were revolutionaries in the government. There were mandarins in the government. Even the French puppet Bao Dai pledged his allegiance. In September of 1945, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam proclaimed a declaration of independence, modeled in language at least after our own. And included in that declaration were these two brief paragraphs. "The whole Vietnamese people, animated by a common purpose, are determined to fight to the bitter end against any attempt by the French colonialists to recover their country. We are convinced that the Allied nations, which at Tehran and San Francisco have acknowledged the principle of self-determination and the equality of nations, will not refuse to acknowledge the independence of Vietnam." But that is precisely what the great powers proceeded to do. At Potsdam in 1945, Stalin sold Ho Chi Minh down the river. Such is the monolithic communist conspiracy that Russian nationalism preempted any concern for a popular front communist leader way down there in Southeast Asia. Stalin's concern was with Eastern Europe. The British concern was with Eastern Asia. So an arrangement was arrived at, which allowed Stalin freedom in the satellite nations, and which divided Vietnam between a Chinese sphere of influence to the north and a British sphere of influence to the south. And the Chinese and the British were given the mandate at Potsdam to restore law and order in Southeast Asia. The United Kingdom, in one of the most ignoble acts of the post-war period, interpreted the restoration of law and order to mean the restoration of the French government. They went about this simply by ordering the newly surrendered Japanese troops to storm the Republic's government buildings and government barracks and to hold these buildings and barracks until the French transport could arrive in large numbers. Washington spoke nobly of national sovereignty, of the independence of the nations, but made not one official protest. General MacArthur in Tokyo did. If there is anything he wrote at the time that makes my blood boil, it is to see our allies in Indochina and Java deploying Japanese troops to reconquer the little peoples we promised to liberate. In 1945, a popular front government, such as will inevitably be established by whatever negotiations are now achieved after 20 years of bloodshed and horror, could have been and was, in fact, a reality. But in that year, as in every subsequent year, the appetites and the ambitions of the great powers overrode the needs of the Vietnamese people. French power was reimposed upon them. 8 years later, we had suddenly discovered that this Ho Chi Minh, who had been sold down the river by Stalin 8 years before, was the major agent of communist conspiracy in Southeast Asia, and the United States was supporting the French resistance to the War of Vietnamese Independence to the tune of 80% of the cost of that bloody war. In April of 1954, Secretary Dulles checked with our allies and with the leaders of Congress whether they were willing to go along with him and proposed military action then against the Vietnamese rebels. No pretense was made then that we were trying to create a world where each people may choose its own path to change. There were no Vietnamese besides a few puppets on our side. Secretary Dulles minced no words. Let me quote his words. The imposition on Southeast Asia of the political system of communist Russia and its Chinese communist allies by whatever means must be a grave threat to the whole free community. The United States feels that the possibility cannot be passively accepted and should be met by united action. In other words, we arbitrarily limited the options available to the Vietnamese people. If they wanted a united front government with all of its dangers, we would not tolerate that choice. It ran against our own policy of containment. It ran against our own line-drawing policy, signified then and symbolized then by the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, which Secretary Dulles had brought into being. The question which we must ask, and there are two, are these. Was the fear which has motivated our policy, and seems to be motivating it today, realistic? And is the method of military intervention an effective way to achieve the end that we seek? Is this fear realistic? I've already indicated, sir, that I do not believe that it is. I will not be backed into the position of describing the communists as angels. They are not. I despise the authoritarianism, the lack of human dignity, the lack of concern for the individual,
which exists under many communist regimes as much as any other man, probably as a man of faith more. But I do not believe that by drawing lines around a contagion, a philosophy which you do not like, you can push it away from you, deny its existence, or contain it. And I do not believe that fear of this philosophy ought to be the underlying motive, the thrust of our American policy. Military intervention to support anti-communist governments is often short-sighted and self-defeating. And this is especially true, sir, when it applies to governments which exist in the emerging, underdeveloped nations of the world. For 10 years, we supported such a government in South Vietnam. The government of Diem was autocratic, tyrannical, imperious, corrupt. Our aid was siphoned off, often into Swiss banks and private bank accounts. That aid, which would have brought about an economic revolution, was slowed down to a snail's pace. There was progress, to be sure. Slow, too slow. And quickly our concern for the protection of that government led to a point at which our military support of that government far exceeded the economic support of the people, in which those who were arrested by the government and imprisoned for dissent were arrested by police trained by Americans, armed by Americans' arms, and incarcerated in jails which had been built and made secure by American firms. Communism breeds where there is want, where there is poverty, where there is fear, where there is misery, where there is a tyrannical government which is supported by a free government, where anti-Americanism becomes one of the bywords of revolution. I trust, sir, you understand that the present hearings of our Senate Foreign Relations Committee are far more than a niggling critique of mistakes which may have been made by your administration in the past, far more than a suggestion of this or that subtlety and nuance in our policy today. Rather, sir, your critics have raised a challenge to the entire basis and thrust of our foreign policy. It is our belief, and it is certainly my belief, that a policy of military support for governments which stand athwart the progress of their people is self-defeating, and that such a policy must be broken before we are trapped again in another Vietnam. Let me make my case from Thailand. You have already announced, sir, that there is evidence of subversion, of communist subversion in Thailand, especially in the northeastern provinces of that country. You've already committed to Thailand 12,000 American military personnel, several wings of our jet aircraft. There is at Korat, near the northeastern province, enough supply, enough armor to equip within 24 hours an entire American division. The military commitment in Thailand has been made in support of an anti-communist government, and that government is, in fact, anti-communist. But it is also oligarchical, repressive, tyrannical. It has never held an election. It has never allowed a constitution to be created for the people. It has never convened a parliament elected by the people. It is a government of the elite. A government which has outlawed labor unions, a government which has clothed all of the dissident press. Like Vietnam, Thailand, my dear Mr. President, is a country which is heavily cleft by terrible ethnic and economic and religious divisions. There are in those very northeast provinces which you have pointed out to us as a source of subversion some 7 million Laos, blood enemies of the Thais for many years, who live in the poorest part of the land and are the poorest citizens of the country, who have no representation in Bangkok, and only in the last year and a half has some of our aid been allowed to trickle through to these provinces. There is in the long, narrow southern peninsula of Thailand some several million Indonesian Muslims who have no representation in the government, no say in their affairs, and who too are among the poorest in the nation. And there are in the great urban centers in Bangkok and the other provincial capitals several million Chinese who have no representation in the government, Chinese who by law are prohibited from entry into politics, from entry into many areas of commerce and many industry and craft. We have never used in Thailand, Mr. President, our aid as a weapon to insist that this government break out of its lethargy, break out of its model of corruption, become a country united in common and concerted. Bangkok, like Saigon, seems to be a capital without a country. The prime minister governs a nation but has no electorate. Thailand never knew the dislocations of colonial rule, has not suffered as deeply as Vietnam. Perhaps war may be avoided in Thailand. But all of the incendiary conditions are there. And if revolution comes, all subversion can do is to apply the match to the existing timber. Subversion cannot be effective unless the people are discontented and have nothing to lose. If that revolution comes, it will be a communist revolution because it must be an anti-American revolution because America is inexorably bound up with the present government, with the government of the few, the government of the past. Mr. President, I'm fully aware that if policies some of us are suggesting are effected, anti-communist governments would fall. Your administration has emphasized aid to governments and containment. We would emphasize aid to peoples, humanity. We are fully aware that this is a tumultuous world. Our own nation, Mr. President, had to go through revolution and civil war before we came into our freedoms and into our maturity. And surely none of these feudalistic, tribalistic states will emerge into the 20th century without some kind of convulsion and turmoil. What we plead with you, sir, is not to align us now with the few in the past, to align us with the hope, the people, the mass, the future. May communist subversion win out in some of these countries? It may. I remind you, Mr. President, of another warning in our Bible. The violence of the wicked shall drag them away because they refuse to do justly. Each nation has its own bundle of ordinary human hopes. No people will long tolerate in this century of burgeoning prosperity where the example of freedom is just across the border. No nation will long tolerate an ideology which destroys its freedom, which saps its hopes, which limits its opportunity. When a leader goes ideologically too far, as Sukarno did in Indonesia, the people rise up, pull him down. Perhaps even communism may be a way station for some of these underdeveloped nations on the way into the future. If such, it must be accepted and outgrown. Mr. President, I am fully and humbly aware of the awesome burden of responsibilities that you bear. I am of the conviction that you have borne them honorably. It you have made your decisions according to your best judgment. But as a man of faith to a man of faith, I plead with you to have faith. To have faith in men, in their hopes, in their decency, in their humanity. And to allow our government to stand abroad for that which we enjoy at home. Justice, opportunity, freedom, and hope. Respectively, yours, Daniel Jeremy.